Hi, Matthias. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Randy. Thanks so much for having me here. I'm glad we could do this interview.
Who were some of the influences on your musical style?
I'd say I've been influenced by a lot of different musicians and styles. I guess, growing up as a rock drummer and country drummer, I did a lot of blues and stuff too. So in my early days, I was influenced by, a lot of the rock people of the day, Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and country artists, Willie Nelson and stuff like that. But then when I got into jazz, I was definitely influenced by, the vibe player that really influenced me the most was Gary Burton. A lot of his early records, and they had a lot of country influences too in his playing, so that was something of a crossover influence for me there. And, the heroes of the day of the classic jazz, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bill Evans, a lot of stuff like that, and I guess Mike Maneri is another big influence, and his band Steps Ahead, people of that nature.
What was it about their playing that you enjoyed so much?
I guess what I really enjoyed about a lot of their playing was, for example, Gary Burton. When I first heard him, he did a lot of, country stuff in his early days too. He had an album called Duster and some fusion records called with Larry Coryell, and they did a lot of fun music too that was not so mainstream jazz, you could say, and it was covering some new ground. And when I heard that stuff, it really really influenced me a lot. And I think to hear the mixture of other elements mixed in with the mainstream jazz is really what I really was excited about. And hearing his other records too, he did a lot of that kind of stuff. And Bill Evans, his harmonic voicings, cluster chords, I loved his style of playing, his lyricalism in his playing. That really excited me a lot.
Do you have any recordings in your collection that are somewhat older that you go back to and listen to from time to time, maybe to gain some ideas or inspiration?
Yeah, I have quite a selection of older recordings too that I listen to, back to big band era, I guess, and up to today. And there's there's so much music out there that there's so much influence to be had. And I can't say that I go out there and really listen to something and take that per se and work on it into a tune or something, but I do get influenced by, I do a lot of listening and listen to as much music as I can from the past, and just try to absorb the whole feel of it, I guess would be my main thing. I try to absorb the feeling of the tune overall and the essence of a whole CD. Some CDs have a certain concept to them, and you just try to take that inside of you and see how it affects your life. And I guess that's the biggest thing I could say I take from older recordings overall, listening to music and what is it doing for me emotionally. And then when I write and compose my own music and play with my group, I try to what kind of mood can I set with this tune? Where can I take the audience, the listener, to on this particular piece of music or something?
Always looking for that situation that can be musically challenging for you as an artist is probably what drives many musicians.
Yeah, situations that can be musically challenging, yeah, they're always around. I would say I started really late playing the vibes. I was a drummer playing rock and roll and country, blues, etc. for so many years that when I got into the vibes, I started really, really late in my mid-20s. I started playing the vibes. So it was really a struggle for me to learn to function properly on the instrument, even all the time, even to this day still, I still find myself I feel like I'm behind a lot of the players I'm playing with that, they started on the instrument when they were 6 years old or something like that, and therefore can function and know more harmonically than I do. So I find myself quite often always challenging myself with the players I'm with and the tunes. But writing my own tunes, you start to develop your own sound, and and you start, you know, I'm definitely better at playing my own tunes and playing other people's tunes. So, you know, I tend to lead my own bands, and leading your own band and everything is quite a full endeavor in itself, and making recordings. So I'm pretty happy just doing that and challenging myself with my own music and my own group. Also, I find that I try to bring in, you know, new artists quite often, players that will, you know, challenge me. Like, we recently played with Greg Osby, and he's got a certain style that he does, and his whole idiom of thought process is just, it's just amazing what he does with his music and where it takes you. So having him on stage with us, you know, that's a real challenge and really fun thing to do. And
anyone else that you bring into the fold?
Also players like Mark Turner, I bring in George Garzone, Kung Vu, the trumpet player, and his electronics. Just opens up a whole new world, and it's always a musically challenging scenario to have these artists in and see what happens and how the group reacts to that.
I know there are many musicians out there who sometimes wish that they could play with some of their favorites who have passed away. I was just wondering, are there any musicians that you would have loved to have played with who are no longer with us?
Yeah, the musicians that aren't around anymore, yeah, there's a lot of them. So, I mean, there's a lot of great cats that would have been fun to play with. I mean, jazz is such a conversational music, and it's so interesting to meet people from around the world. I mean, just in regular day, you know, just to meet people in general, it's and have conversations, it's fun. But on a jazz musical context, I mean, she's love to play with Coltrane and Miles and Bill Evans, all these guys. I mean, they would all have been quite the interesting trip to play with and see what happens there. So I could just go on and on about all the different musicians. So, you know, hopefully during my lifetime I get to play with a lot of the players that maybe 100 years from now will be looked on and I could say, yeah, I played with them.
You mentioned before that you played the drums for a while. Are you still playing them?
Yeah, I don't play the drums that much anymore. I found for myself I really needed to focus with my music. And once I really started getting into jazz and the vibes, I just found that trying to play drums also just kind of hindered my process. And I found myself, you know, do I take this gig and play the vibes? Do I do that gig and play the drums? What do I really want to do? And it really came down to I really want to write my own music, play my own music, and usually be the lead instrument or melodic part of that sound. So I've really kind of shied away from the drums lately, and can't say that I've played much at all in the past 10 years. But, you know, if something came along and it was a really good thing for me to do on drums, I would still play. But it'd have to really sway me from what I'm doing here elsewise.
If you had to make a recording with only one musician, Matthias, who would it be?
Yeah, who would I like to record with? One musician, that's always a tough question. I guess there's so many great players out there. I guess I've always been a big fan of Pat Metheny. You know, his spectrum of music is quite large. If you look at his whole record output and the different styles he's done and his sounds and compositions, I could really love to do a record with him and you know, of my own music, but with his sound. I could see myself really, really enjoying that. That would be a lot of fun. But, you know, there's a lot of players out there. I'd love to record with Greg Osby someday, too. I could really do a real recording with him. But, yeah, there's so many players.
You mentioned earlier that there are so many musicians out there that you would love to play with. Well, let's say you were to put together a dream band. Who would it consist of?
Yeah, dream bands is a funny thing. You know, as musicians, you dream a lot. But, you know, I love touring with my own group, and I, you know, record as much with my own group, too. That's really a good dream band right there, where you can just really tour a lot and record, you know, that kind of consistency is really good. But, you know, my last record with Kurt Rosenwinkel, Mark Turner, and Reuben Rogers, and Greg Hutchison, I mean, that was a dream band right there when I put that CD project together, and for me that was a lot of fun, and music very extremely musically challenging for me, and it was, you know, great to play my own music with them. You know, I get to play with all of them once in a while, but it's hard to have a whole group thing with that sort of band because everybody has their own projects and they're so busy touring that it's really hard to pull everybody together. But we did a CD release party and pretty much had the whole group there and got to play live for that, and ended up that Mark Turner couldn't make it, but then ended up having Greg Osby play there, so that was really fun, and just having him at the table brought in a whole new thing in with that group there too.
Anyone else maybe outside of your own band that you have now?
But, you know, also, you know, I'd love another dream band, maybe like with Chris Potter and Scott Coley and Bill Stewart. I mean, they do a lot of stuff. They have great records. I'd love to play with them. That could be a lot of fun.
When you're touring, do you tend to stick with the same group of musicians, or do you change musicians frequently?
Yeah, touring is always a funny thing with the players because, like I just said, it's sort of like people have different schedules all the time, and the jazz, the whole jazz business is not as strong as it used to be, so there's not as many gigs, so everybody's struggling a bit more now, and, you know, taking other gigs with other groups, so, you know, you could be working on a tour for, you know, for six months from now, and people say they can do it, and then, you know, it ends up that maybe they landed another tour with another group, and which, you know, is 3 times longer and pays more or something, and everybody's economically, you know, has to really pay the bills. So it's a hard struggle to pull it all together and try to tour with the same group of guys. But, you know, the more touring that you do, the more comfortable you feel with the band, and the more comfortable it is to pass on other projects and say, yeah, I'm going to stick with this group. And you know, it's just, you know, how far can you book ahead? If you can book far ahead, your tours far enough ahead, you can usually have a pretty good, solid, steady band all the time. But then again, it depends on the players. You know, if you have really, really well-known players on every instrument, then they're really, you know, hard to get quite often. But yeah, you know, it's fun to not always have the same players, and every tour has a different lineup. It brings, you know, an element of excitement to the table every time, just having that new sound, that new person, new thought process behind their instrument and how they perceive your tunes.
So when you were growing up, what music did you listen to?
Yeah, when I grew up, I mean, I didn't even listen to jazz at all until my mid-20s when I started playing the vibe. So I grew up listening to rock and roll and, you know, everything from Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, like I said before, you know, bands like Styx, and you know, of course, listen to the Beatles and Bob Dylan and all that kind of stuff. And I still listen to that. I still like listening to a lot of the pop and rock world music. But you know, listen to the jazz too now. So it's so much out there. A lot of classical music. My parents, you know, pretty much listen to classical music, so I did hear a lot of classical growing up. But, I mean, they weren't musicians or anything, but definitely a lot of opera and classical in the house.
When you were growing up, did music come naturally to you?
Yeah, I couldn't say that I was a natural musician at all. My parents, they weren't musically inclined at all. My sisters, no musicality at all either. I started off playing in the school bands, playing drums, and, you know, I started taking lessons and stuff, and eventually switched over to vibes in my mid-20s, and I'd say a lot of it was, you know, I had put a lot of work into it, and study a lot and practice a lot, and I couldn't say that it really came natural to me, especially the vibes. I struggled for quite a while trying to make it all happen and pull it together, and it's still a struggle. So I guess there are some people that are just naturally gifted performers and players, but I sure don't feel like I'm one of them.
What is your most satisfying CD release to date?
Yeah, that's always a funny question, the most satisfying record to date. You know, it's sort of like, you know, my next one is always going to be my most satisfying. The one I haven't recorded, that's going to be the most satisfying one. You know, I guess being an artist, you're always, you know, recording your life as you see it, and or maybe how you want to see it. So every record sort of represents a certain time in my life, you know, and the music I was writing at that time, and also your ability as a musician. How, you know, you have certain strengths and weaknesses as you progress and grow as a musician, and some things, you know, that I might have played on my first record, you know, I could play better now. But then again, sometimes the things you don't know are sometimes the things that make the music unique. So, you know, every album has its uniqueness in that sense, and the players that were there. And, you know, they really are snapshots of time, because you go into the studio for 1 or 2 days, you record, and that's sort of what you're hearing. And but, you know, there's so much music going on every day. You're, you know, playing with different musicians all the time, recording, touring around a lot, and every time you replay, it's sort of a different thing. Even if you play the same, you know, playing the same tunes, it's improvised music so much that it's always changing. So it's hard to pinpoint and say, yeah, that's the defining moment of that CD. It's just one day in 1 year back, you know, back then, that's what I did on that one day, and that's how it came out. So, but it's sort of a general representation of the group. So I like them all. I can't say that I like one more than the other, but, you know, the latest one I like a lot, and let's see what happens with the next one.
You know, Matthias, I think that maintaining a childlike aspect throughout your life is very important, especially when you're creating, and because jazz is such a unique form of music, maintaining a childlike quality is always important throughout not only the performing of one's compositions, but the writing as well.
Yeah, feeling like a child, that's a funny thing. I definitely believe that. I find that being a musician, you're always learning and always in that search to learn in that creative mode. So, yeah, I still feel like a kid. I always have felt like a kid, and, you know, as life goes on and you are getting older, I still feel like I'm, you know, a teenager, actually. Yeah, maybe even a lot younger sometimes. It's just, it's a funny feeling, but I definitely believe music keeps you young, and especially jazz, it sure keeps you going. I love it.
So have you incorporated any of your childhood memories into your compositions at all?
But, you know, a lot of the music I write to references to my childhood, too. And I think that comes out the very first tune on my very first album, actually. It was called Children, and it was a very playful kind of tune. And, again, that was, again, written from looking out a window. And, you know, I'd see a lot of kids playing in a courtyard below my street there, and hear them screaming and stuff. And that filtered through my music, and I always kind of dreamt back to my childhood years when I wrote that tune, and that definitely, what you're saying is true. And there was another tune on my latest album, a tune called Wish Song, off the Same Time Twice album, that was based on the reflections of childhood, of always wishing for something, you know, when you're a kid at Christmas time and birthdays, and just in general, you're always dreaming a lot and wishing for things, and I always remember days on end of daydreaming, you know, and wishing for things, and so I wrote that tune based on those thoughts, and you know, there's always I wrote a bit of a darker section of that tune too, there, a little dark section there, where I guess as a kid too, you know, you're scared a lot too, scared of growing older, and scared of what growing older means, and all the things like that, and so when I wrote that tune, there was this little, you know, just a little section that got a bit darker, and that was in reference to the darker side of that, too.
How did your album Windows Up, Windows Down come about? Did it take very long to record?
Yeah, the Window Up, Window Down album, that was my first debut CD as a leader, and had my own tunes, all my own compositions. It was sort of like the band I was working with at the time. I mean, I recorded in 1994, was it?
Yes, it was.
I'd gone to Berkeley. It was just, you know, finishing up Berkeley. And these were the players that I was playing with a lot around town. We were doing a lot of gigs around town. And this was the music that reflected my life at that time. And, you know, it was recorded pretty quickly. We just went to a studio one day and recorded it, directed that. And there it is, you know, no overdubs. Hardly any, it wasn't even really any mixing because it was directed that. So what you hear is what we did, and that's just what it is. And that's the beauty of jazz, you know, that's that afternoon, one day in that year, but playing those tunes. And I mean, the whole album, again, was based on looking out my window in my apartment and writing about life and as I see it from the window there, from the piano, filtering through my, you know, my thought process. And but the tunes are sort of based on this whole message, you know, that's a personal message to me and my view on life too. And it's kind of a cryptic message, but if you take all the tune titles and read them down, as with a few other words added in, it sort of creates this sort of poetic poem or something. I don't know what you want to call it, but it basically goes, children free fall through abstractional pictures while the fruit lady just says anything and names introspectives as symmetrical jive. You know, but that has a certain, I guess, cryptic meaning to it if you listen to the words. And what does that mean to you? I mean, it has a certain meaning to me. And, you know, it's just about life and the things that go on and what you see. You know, as I saw, look out my window, and, you know, that's the beauty of music. You know, you can, I'm not going to tell you exactly what it all means, but, to me, but, you know, it means something different to everybody, and that's the beauty of music when you listen to lyrics of songs and instrumental music like we're playing. You know, you can listen to it, and it's going to create certain images in your head, and the titles, it's going to, you know, it's all going to accumulate to some kind of emotional context for yourself within your own life, and that's the beauty of art.
Another thing that I find very interesting is the idea of when you're composing, to always have an idea or multiple ideas in your head that are flexible and sort of free-floating. They're not rigid, so you can play around with them sort of like putty. You know, you can manipulate them and work them. And what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, you know, with keeping it floating and the concepts and not having a rigid concept going. I mean, jazz to me has always been a, you know, how can you change this to make it interesting again in another way? I mean, that's one of the things. My latest album is called Same Time Twice, and it's referenced to Deja Vu. As a musician, the deja vu as a musician, where you're playing music and you might be playing the same tunes over and again, or as you say, maybe it's the same concept, and you're constantly floating these concepts past the band that you're playing with and touring with and to the audience. But the idea is that you're going to keep changing the music and seeing where it goes night after night if you're on tour or with the different players and have different solos and take it to different areas and have different discussions, yet on the same concept or the same tune. And Same Time Twice is in reference to that. Like, people say, don't play the same thing twice, but you can have the same time twice. So, you know, the time being the tune is the time, the feeling, and getting off on that and doing that every night, but at the same time, doing something different as much as possible. But at the same time, it's sort of a twofold thing because, you know, if you're always changing it every night, you know, you're going to be telling a different story. And then sometimes, you know, you might not tell the best story the next night. And then maybe the following night you tell what you thought was the best story ever. And then it's like the following night you say to yourself, man, we should repeat that story again because that was a really good story. But by doing that, you're not really telling, you know, you're not really following that true jazz guideline that a lot of us want to follow. And so if you try to repeat what you said the night before, you know, you're not going to do it as well because it's no longer spontaneous. It's now you're trying to copy what you did the night before, and the night before had all the different elements of maybe a different audience, different emotional feelings throughout the day, different feelings on stage. I mean, all these things come into play when you're talking about jazz and playing jazz. And so you really got to try to stay open, but also understand that, you know, you're not always going to have the same good nights, and it just varies, and that's something that's hard to deal with quite often. And I'm not sure the audience, you know, maybe some of the audiences aren't hip to that the musicians are searching for that new story to tell you, and sometimes it's not always going to be, you know, as good as it could be, I guess. But that's jazz.
One of the great sax players, I think, on the jazz scene is currently working in Boston and the Eastern Seaboard. His name is George Garzon. He appeared on your second release, Shadow of the Vibe. What was it like working with him?
Yeah, the following CD, Shadow of the Vibe, with George Garzon, that was great. You know, after I graduated Berkeley, a lot of the players I played with had moved on. A lot of people moved to New York. You know, you start searching out other players to play with, and George Garzon, great heavy player from Boston, has a great band with John Lockwood called The Fringe, very avant-garde-ish kind of thing. No music per se, it's no charts, they just play free, basically. And, you know, I saw him play quite a lot around Boston. I thought it'd be sure would be great to play with George. And, you know, I came up with the music for my next album, and I asked him if he wanted to do it, and we did it. And it was great. It was, again, it's just basically going to the studio one day, play the tunes, there it is. A lot of them were first takes, and, you know, what you hear is what we did, and not really any rehearsing, or not much rehearsing. I mean, there was a bit, I guess, with the other guys. I didn't really do any rehearsing with George. But, you know, he's a great player. Knows his horn, you know, knows how to get around it. And definitely brought a new element to the table and raised the bar for all of us. Playing with John Lockwood, too, great bassist. So, you know, we went and toured a bit on that album a lot. Did some festivals. We played the Litchfield Jazz Festival. I took George up to Toronto. We went and played at the top of the center there for a week. You know, stuff around the New England area. So it's great. Great playing with him, and probably going to do some more in the future.
What's your favorite piece off of Same Time Twice?
Yeah, again, about favorite pieces, you know, like you mentioned, Jade, you like that a lot. Jade was one of my favorite tunes, too. I liked it a lot. But, you know, again, as you look with, you know, what's your favorite CD and everything, as you said before, I guess for favorite pieces, again, you know, there's different qualities of emotion on this CD of my life and what I was thinking, and each tune sort of represents something different, yet the whole CD as a whole, you know, again, says something as a whole too. But per tune, each tune, you know, it depends on the time of day when you listen. You know, for me, I listen to one tune in the morning, and if I listen to it again later at night, I wouldn't have the same emotion about it. I wouldn't feel the same way about it. Yet, if you listen to another piece of music on the album, you feel a certain way. So, and it changes daily. So it's the funny thing about music and art. It really changes daily, and even hourly when you listen to music. Certain things in music grab you at certain times, and that's just the way it is.
One of my favorite songs off of your album, Same Time Twice, is the composition Jade. What is this song about?
Yeah, Jade. Love that tune a lot myself. It was one of my favorite tunes off the album, too. You know, Kurt Rosenwinkel is playing, you know, his acoustic guitar on that one, and definitely adds a certain ambience with that class, with that nylon string guitar he's playing. It's beautiful, like what he does with that. And I mean, the whole tune, Jade, first of all, I mean, I was very inspired by Bill Evans, really checked out a lot of Bill Evans and, you know, the Blue and Green tune, beautiful piece of music that he did with Miles, you know. Still debatable, did Miles write that or did Bill Evans write that? But, you know, when you think about the title, Blue and Green, and, you know, this, you know, when I think when I wrote this tune, Jade, I mean, Jade has, you know, certain colors to it, and it's almost sort of a bluish green kind of thing, too. And, you know, Jade, when you think about blue and green, it's like, you can think of blue as an emotion. I mean, you think of colors as emotions, and when you think about jade, and you think of jade as an emotion, you know, you think of the color of jade, and it's emotion. And you also think, you know, it's you add the letter D to it, and you got the word jaded, you know, and you think about life, and wow, you know, I definitely don't want to become jaded in my life, and you know, it's so easy. I see that when you look at society, how people become jaded so quickly, even at a young age. And there's so many good things in life, but you know, as we were talking about before, it's like there's a lot of, the world is a crazy place, so it's very easy to get jaded quickly with what's going on. And this tune was, you know, a reflection of all what I'm saying here is the coloring, the emotions, and being so close to being jaded, you know, jade. It's sort of a ballad, yet it's not a ballad, and it creates these certain emotions. And for me, that's sort of where it came from.
Your previous recordings were basically vibes, sax, drums, and bass. Now, on Same Time Twice, you introduced guitar into the mix. Was Kurt your first choice?
Yeah, when I first, you know, started playing the vibes, I was, you know, approaching the vibes too from the standpoint of a piano, playing it like a piano, and just doing the classic quartet thing of vibes, saxophone, acoustic bass, and drums. And you know, the vibes would be replacing the piano in your basic standard quartet setting. So you know, I was very drawn to that, and you know, it had a certain sonic sound to it that I really liked. And on my latest album, Same Time Twice, you know, I wanted to add the element of guitar. I had played with guitar players a lot before. I had done some fusion things also while I was at Berkeley, and but we never really got to record them professionally. I mean, I do have recordings of the fusion stuff, but it was never released. So, you know, again, it's like as a jazz musician, you do a lot of different things, and what gets put out to the public is not always what you're always doing. Is the other aspect, you know, there's a lot of hidden material that people will never hear. But yeah, well, on Same Time Twice, when I decided to bring guitar into the mix again, I mean, Kurt Rosenwinkel, phenomenal player, he was at Berkeley when I was there too, so I had known him from my Berkeley days, you know, and I didn't know him that well or anything, and we didn't play together when we were at Berkeley. But, I mean, I definitely saw him play a lot, and I was aware of him and loved his playing. And, you know, as I matured as a player and grew, and wanted to record this next CD project, and I wanted to add guitar, I mean, he was definitely my first choice. He's just a beautiful player, and his classical, his acoustic playing, honest classical, you know, nylon string guitar, it sounds great. I just love it. So yeah, he was my first choice, and you know, I called him up and said, hey, you know, remember me from Berkeley, you want to do this? And yeah, which has all worked out, and glad we did it.
Matthias, here are some names that I'd like to throw your way, and I want you to give me the first impressions that run across your mind. We're going to start off with a vibes player that most people have probably never heard of, but those in the jazz world know quite a bit, I'm sure, of his work, and his name is Dave Pike.
First thing that comes to my mind, all right, Dave Pike, let me see, Pike's Peak, album he did, great vibist, he was a vibe player, he's still around, did a great album called Pike's Peak with, I think Bill Evans was on piano on that one, and really enjoyed that album.
I think one of the most talented arrangers and composers on the jazz scene at the moment, and certainly someone who gave an excellent performance here at the Ottawa International Jazz Festival, is Maria Schneider. Now, what are your thoughts on this gifted musician?
Maria Schneider. I can't say I've heard a lot of her music, but, I mean, she's an arranger, you know, I guess, coming from the Gil Evans School, I guess, and, you know, I've seen her name around a lot. I can't say I've really checked out what she's done, but she's doing well for herself. I see her name out there a lot.
Another throwback to one of the great vibists from the past, and someone who is, to my knowledge, still performing, the great Terry Gibbs.
Terry Gibbs, great vibist. I've heard him quite a bit here and there. Seen him play live. Very, very melodic player. I even play his mallets. He uses his own mallet. He has a he's on a Vic Firth mallet artist, and I use a lot of his. He has some mallets I use a lot. I like the sound that he gets. So I use sort of his mallets, his medium mallets with you know, I have Vic Firth company extend the length of the mallets a bit longer for my tastes, but first thing that comes to my mind, that was it.
Probably the granddaddy of arrangers and composers of the last 40 years, and someone who Maria Schneider was heavily influenced by, Gil Evans.
I see, Gil Evans. Again, another great arranger, probably influenced Maria Schneider a lot. You know, loved some of the stuff he did in his early days with Miles. But then again, I can't say that I've really checked out a lot of Gil Evans to the nth degree.
And finally, certainly one of my favorite vibe players of all time, someone who's always inspired me and always made me smile when I heard his playing, Bobby Hutcherson.
Bobby Hutcherson, yeah. Great vibraphonist. I've checked out a lot of his music over the years. Beautiful lyrical player. Coming from more of a two-mallet approach, playing, you know, one mallet in each hand. I'm playing more of the Gary Burton style, two mallets in each hand, playing more like a piano. He plays the vibes more like a horn player would play, single lines. Beautiful player, though. I guess one of his albums that I really loved, it was called Solo Quartet. You know, on the first, it was, you know, it was before CDs. It was an album he had, and the first side of the album was him playing solo in a studio situation, and he was overdubbing marimba and xylophones and all these different types of mallet instruments. And then on the second side, it was a quartet with Billy Higgins on drums and McCoy Tyner on piano. And I think McCoy, that was when McCoy first came out of retirement, because McCoy went into retirement for a while. And that was a beautiful album. Just love the sound that he had on that album with this quartet. I can't remember the bassist right now. But beautiful album, and that really inspired me when I first started playing the vibes.
Do you have any thoughts on the state of popular music as it stands today?
Yeah, the state of the popular music. That's always an interesting question. You know, I guess I think about that once in a while, but I find myself so involved with the music that I'm playing myself and of my peers, and, you know, what do I want to listen to? So I search out a lot of music on CDs, you know, and throughout history of music that I want to check out. So the popular music of the day, I don't really even hear it that much, except on the occasional radio station that I might have to come across, or on TV. And you know, geez, what to say about it? A lot of it I don't like. Yeah, I don't like a lot of it, but, you know, there's some nice stuff out there too. And it's you know, I guess it's, I mean, as you grow older, you know, I always confuse that issue. You know, is it really that? I mean, all of our elders said when we were growing up, the music that we listened to was horrible, and their parents said their music was horrible, and I think that shall always be the case. Now, whether it really is worse or not, I mean, geez, I mean, there's some good stuff out now, and there's some really horrible stuff too, so. It's, you know, I just sort of, I don't think about it too much, don't dwell on it, do what I do, and do the music I want to do, and that's what I do.
How is work these days for you, Matthias? Do you find it hard getting gigs?
Yeah, in terms of the work, I mean, I'm a busy guy. I find myself being way too busy all the time. But, you know, it's not always being busy the way I want to be busy, so that's the issue, I guess. You know, there's not as much work as there used to be. That's a definite thing. I mean, back in the 60s, there was a lot of work for jazz musicians in the 50s. And I mean, all the clubs now, or a lot of the clubs are just drying up, and you know, there's just not as much jazz. It's just not as popular. So there's not as many clubs, so there's not as much work. And there's only so many festivals, and the festivals can only have so many people, and, you know, it's a crazy business. So, I mean, I'm trying to work more and more and try to get, you know, the best gigs I can get. But I find myself, you know, I've definitely said to myself a number of years ago, I'm going to stop doing certain types of gigs just to make money. I, at this point, am only doing gigs for my own group now, playing my original music that I feel artistically compelled to do. Otherwise, I don't find myself... I mean, I used to do a lot of restaurant gigs, you know, a lot of gigs as background music, and they can be artistically great, but I found myself, you know, I have a job at Berkeley too, so I decided I'd rather just really just promote myself as a full-fledged jazz musician, playing my own music the way I want to play it, and to a listening audience, and... you know, make my money that way, but, you know, also work at Berkeley and help that. But I'd rather be a full-time player out there all the time, making my living and just recording music and living off record sales. But that's a hard thing to do. It really is. But, yeah, that's a dream. I'll see what happens. Still keep working at it.
Do you spend a lot of time practicing?
Yeah, I definitely try to spend a lot of time practicing. You know, it's hard to have a steady routine, but I'm definitely trying to work on that more and more, and try to put in 2 to 3 hours a day, if possible, every day, no matter what, on music, you know, hands on the instrument. You know, there's so many other things too going on. I mean, if you're touring a lot, you know, you're already spending 3 hours on the instrument already, 2 to 3 hours playing every night. So, you know, if I'm touring, I definitely try to do more warm-up things, and then maybe off-instrument practicing, just rhythmic things maybe with the hands, and a lot of listening. You know, when you're on the road, you just do a lot of listening and to records. And, I mean, that's a practicing in itself, just trying to listen, you know, not listen as background music, but listen without, you know, put on some headphones and just close your eyes and listen to a whole record, a whole CD straight through, with no interruptions, and, you know, really let the music carry you into another world. To me, that's really important to do that kind of stuff, because that's where you really dig deep down inside of yourself and hear the music for what it is and how it affects you as a human being. But yeah, I try to practice every day, and you know, special techniques. I mean, wow, that's an endless topic there. You know, I'm always working on new things to develop my vocabulary as a musician, as a jazz artist. But, you know, also, you know, you have to go back and look, you know, what were you working on 10 years ago? You know, can you still do that? Do you need to refresh yourself on that? So, and then also just, you know, working on the tunes that you're writing. You have to, you know, as a composer, you're also composing music. So... you need to write, spend time writing, and you spend time, you know, practicing what you've written and trying to figure out, you know, what's special about the tunes that you're writing and how to improvise over them. And, you know, it's an unlimited amount of things that you can be practicing. So, just never enough time. Time is of the essence.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more there. What are you listening to these days?
Yeah, what music do I listen to these days? Well, I mean, you definitely listen to a lot of yourself, that's for sure. You know, yeah, when you're when you play your own music all the time, when you're on the road touring, you know, you get to hear your own group a lot. When you write your own music, you always, you know, I always record myself, so, you know, I definitely have to listen to myself a lot, and you listen to yourself and work on things that you want to work on, and, you know, edit your playing, learn to edit yourself, so definitely have to listen to yourself a lot, and then listen to your peers that you're playing with, you know, as you record the group a lot live, and listen to what your peers are doing, and, you know, check out what they're doing more from a recording standpoint, you know, as we tour, listen to what they're doing on stage closer from live recordings. And then also, check out all the players that I really enjoy. I mean, Chris Potter's music, I love that. Kurt Rosenwinkel's music, his CDs, Mark Turner, Greg Osby, Wayne Shorter, Pat Metheny, you know, still listen to Gary Burton music. It's endless amount of music out there. Still listening to rock and roll music, still listening to Joni Mitchell, Pat Travers, the guitarist, once in a while. I'm always checking out, you know, what's coming out on the ECM label. Always been a big fan of the ECM label, so listening to music from them. Wayne Shorter, bought the new Nicholas Payton lately. I guess it's always something new. What do I have on order? I just ordered some more Joni Mitchell, ordered some more Pat Metheny. What else did I order? You know, I'll get into some of the folk music too. There's some folk players. Emmylou Harris, stuff like that.
I know this is a difficult question to answer, but do you remember the best concert that you ever saw?
See, best concert I ever saw, I really couldn't tell you. There's so many phases in life, different mindsets, different eras, 80s and 90s. Now we're in the 2000s, the new century here. I've seen a lot of great shows, and it just depends on jazz. Seen a lot of great jazz shows, a lot of great rock shows, great blues shows, great country shows, great opera, great classical music. Yeah, it's so much great music out there. I couldn't pinpoint that for you.
Was there a defining moment in your life that made you want to play music?
Yeah, when I started playing the drums in the school bands, I think I was in grade 7 or something. They had the school program and it was a class you could take, and it just seemed like a lot of fun and something to try out. So I tried that out and I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun, and I think in terms of defining moments, I think when I started playing the Vibes, and I really wanted to learn how to compose music. That's why I switched over to Vibes in the first place. I was a rock drummer, and I was doing studio sessions, and people would always bring in their own music, and I never understood how to put music together. I was always playing drums, and I didn't feel like I was playing music. So I really wanted to learn how to play music and understand music, compose music, and I started going to college to learn into a music program to learn the theory of music, and that's where I got introduced to Vibes. And then, really had to struggle with that for a number of years. And then when I heard some Gary Burton records, Times Square was an album of his with Roy Haynes on drums and Tiger Kashi on trumpet, Steve Swallow on bass. When I heard that record, I really went, wow, this is really cool. I can see how, jazz can go in different directions when I heard that album, and with the vibes especially. I learned, wow, I could listen to this vibe player, what he's doing, and it was so different compared to what Milt Jackson and Bobby Hutcherson were doing. And that was a defining moment for me to say, yeah, I could do this, and I'm really into this. This could be really cool. And that from that point on, I think I changed my life and really started working on the vibes. I did go out on the road again a bit more, playing drums for another 5 years. But then I started bringing my vibes with me on the road and practicing hotel rooms a lot. And eventually to the point where I went to Berkeley and actually got to study with Gary Burton himself.
Do you remember the first concert that you ever attended?
Let's see, first concert I ever attended. Now, you don't say jazz, I'm not saying jazz concert, but first concert. Of course, I went to some concerts with my parents when I was a kid, so I'm trying to remember. You know, I went to some classical concerts, but I don't recall what they were at this point. But let me see, in my teenage years, I went to some early rock, when I first started going to rock concerts, in Canada there, and some of the Canadian bands at that time, April Wine. I loved going to see April Wine and the band called Trooper. I remember seeing Prism. Those were the early days. And then, the first jazz concert I went to, some of the very first ones, when I first started getting into jazz, I saw Chick Corea when he was touring with Miroslav Vichus. I'm pronouncing his last name right, and Roy Haynes on drums, that trio album that they did, and that was a great concert. I really enjoyed seeing Roy Haynes play then too. That really hit me to what Roy Haynes was doing, and Chick Corea. The whole trio was just great. Seeing them, I also saw Miles Davis back in the 80s, early 80s, doing this electric band. That was really cool. I think it was Mike Stern on guitar. I can't remember. It was so far back then, but...
Actually, it was Mike Stern, because I remember seeing Miles on several occasions back in the mid-80s, and I don't believe that John Scofield was playing with him then. He might have been, but at least the shows that I saw back then featured Mike Stern, and I believe Bob Berg was on sax at the time.
That was a really cool concert. He played with his back towards the audience the whole time. I do remember that. But great musician.
I'm sure that in your travels, you've come across many musical stories that were rather funny. And I'm just wondering if you could share maybe one or two of them with us today that happened to you.
Funny musical stories. Let me think. I don't know if I think that too funny. I think the funniest thing that's ever happened was, if you think back in the 80s, in the long-haired days of the 80s, I was a rock drummer playing hard rock drums, double bass drums in a hard rock band, the crazy 80s, and I started getting involved in jazz and enjoying jazz, and I was on the road with these rock bands, and I started bringing my vibes with me on the road. So I started practicing the vibraphone in my hotel room during the day while I was playing rock and roll at night. And I guess the funniest thing was that, the rest of the band couldn't make sense of what I was doing. They would come into my room and be like, "What are you doing, What is that instrument? I've never seen that before, And I had just started playing, so I didn't know much about it, so it didn't sound too good either. And I practiced a lot with Jamie Ebersold records on the road, and it was just kind of funny. The guys in the long hair and leather jackets and the groupies or something might come into the hotel room and, they'd come and look at me. They'd just look at this instrument and scratch their head and like, "What is going on?" They couldn't figure me out. What I was doing, trying to play this music and play this instrument. It's definitely a bizarre instrument. It's off the beaten path, definitely. So I guess that's kind of like my funniest musical story.
With the emergence of the internet, how has this new paradigm affected your relation with your fans?
Yeah, the internet, it's been great for people being able to get in touch with artists and what they're interested in. And, you know, you can you put up a web page and you can hear some of the samples, and you can buy music directly. You can see the tour itineraries. You can sort of see what's going on with the artist. So, yeah, it's been great for me. I mean, I get, you know, emails all the time from people around the world, and you know, it just really opens up your whole, you know, fan base, I guess, and people from all over the world can check you out on the web now and communicate with you, and it's a very interesting thing, the whole internet. It's going to be interesting to see where it goes, we shall see where it goes.
To many trumpet players, Louis Armstrong is the core of their development. And when it comes to vibes, it could be argued that Lionel Hampton is the granddaddy of the vibes for most vibists. Now, what did Lionel Hampton mean to you as an artist?
Yeah, Lionel Hampton is definitely one of the granddaddies of the vibes. I mean, even before him, Red Norvo, I mean, Lionel Hampton was inspired by Red Norvo. So, Red Norvo recently passed away too, you know, as did Lionel. What did Lionel mean to me as an artist? I've heard some of his music. I can't say I've checked out Lionel Hampton deeply. I haven't, you know, he's got so many recordings out there. The stuff I've heard, I've liked a lot. You know, he was a certain entertainer too. He played drums and vibes and jumped between the two of them a lot on stage. He was a showman type of thing too. You know, that inspired me a lot to see that. But, you know, he did what he wanted to do, and he believed in the vibes, and that was great. You know, he made it happen, and he kept playing, you know, all the way till his death, basically. He played all his life, and that was, to me, that's a great thing. That if an artist can keep doing their art till the day they die, it's they fulfilled their mission of life and as an artist, to tell their story through their art and let it be captured through the art and for people to hear from days, you know, 100 years from now, you can still hear Lionel Hampton records, in his 90s. Actually, a bass player played with Christian Fabian Bausch. He played with Lionel in Lionel's band at the very end, and it's on his last album. So, I have a bit of a connection there with Lionel that way, and I actually haven't heard that last album yet, but I'm not sure when it's coming out, or if it is out yet. He was a great, great, great vibist.
Let's go way back and see if you can remember your first live gig as a professional.
Yeah, my first live gig as a professional. I was in Alberta playing in a country band. Playing drums, I think that's one of my first professional experiences, going on the road with a country band. It was called the Lind Hill Band. Must have been about like 1982. Traveling around Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba. And, you know, it was like a trio or a quartet country group. And, you know, that was my first experience going out and playing live and touring and getting the feel of that whole lifestyle. I had toured before as a, you know, in the school bands. We would travel a bit and go to British Columbia, etc., from Alberta and tour for about a week. But in terms of getting paid and making a living, yeah, the country band, that was the first thing. My first gig as a vibist was in Boston, actually. I never gig professionally in Canada, but after being in Boston for a while, you know, I started playing around here and played at a jazz club in town here, and it was a good time and a good learning experience, and always keep looking forward.
You know, many of the great jazz musicians had a tendency to surround themselves with younger musicians to maybe gain some inspiration and ideas along the way. What are your thoughts on this, Matthias?
Yeah, that goes back to the whole mentoring process too, you know, with the whole touring. I mean, it used to be like Miles and Art Blakey, you know, they would bring in the younger cats and mentor them into the jazz world, you know, what, you know, the language of jazz and what it's all about, going on the road, touring and learning on stage. But, you know, those days are kind of gone now. There's just not enough gigs anymore. And I mean, it does exist, but just not as much as it used to, I think. And so, you know, there are a few cats that do get the calls from the masters, and they go out and tour, and that's great, you know. But for myself, I guess maybe also being a vibe player, there's just not as much call for people calling vibe players. So, you know, I find myself putting my own bands together more and just touring that way. But, you know, I do bring in guest artists all the time, and that to me, again, is just having them on stage. You know, having Greg Osby on stage with our group, I mean, it's you learn so much standing next to him and talking to him and going out for dinner with him and just hanging out and, you know, discussing life and music.
I've asked this question of several musicians, and it's one of the most difficult questions to answer. If you had never pursued a career playing jazz, what would you have done instead?
Yeah, if I never started playing jazz, well, you know, I was a rock and roll drummer. Played a lot of hard rock bands in the 80s, and you know, that was a lot of fun. I could have kept doing that, but it was really crazy. It was, for me, it was just getting too crazy. That's why I got out of there. And I, you know, musically, I was feeling a bit stifled, and I got into jazz, and it's been great. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of great things about playing hard rock too that I love doing. I love playing hard rock drums. So I could have kept doing that, maybe. Even before I was a musician, one of the first things I wanted to do was be a cartoonist. I was always drawing cartoons as a kid. I was pretty good at it, so I thought that could be a fun occupation, and you know, it'd be a career, like a real career, where I'm really enjoying what I'm doing and getting off on it, and this is what I, you know, it would affect me deeply. You know, when you do, it'd be sort of an artistic thing too, to do the cartoons and you know, write your own cartoon captions about life, you know, but more from a comedian standpoint, I guess, you know. And also I was also into airplanes. I wanted to be a pilot. When I was a kid, I used to fly a lot of remote control airplanes and build my own planes and fly them. You know, that too was a sort of an artistic endeavor. It was a hobby that I took very seriously. And, you know, I built these models, and, you know, they took months and months and months to build. And then, you know, quite a lot of money, actually, to make them. And then you go fly them. And got into the whole race. There was these racing teams I used to get on. You'd race these airplanes. They were model airplanes, so remote control. And that was really exciting, and that got me into wanting to be a pilot, so I started working on my private's license to be a private pilot, and, you know, never followed through with that all the way, but, yeah, being a pilot was definitely something that would have been of interest to me, but, you know, as soon as I got the music bug, the music really took over my whole life, and it's been overwhelming since.
Performing and writing, are they separate, or do they go hand in hand?
I mean, that whole thing about performing and writing material, for me, it's both. It's hand in hand. You live your life, you write your music, and then you play your music out to the audience, and you get the feedback, and you go back to your studios, and you write your music again, and perfect it. You know, compositionally as much as you can, bring it to the band, and then play it as a jazz tune, and see where it goes again. And you know, it's the combination of the two, the performing and the writing, complete the whole. With, you know, some people just, I guess, play standards all their life, and for me, I would be half fulfilled. I just couldn't fulfill maybe even less, because for me, performing is performing my own music, and that to me is the ultimate high.
I'd like to feature something from your first album. What would you like to hear?
Yeah, from that CD, Window Up, Window Down, let's play the tune called Pictures. I mean, that whole album was a sort of concept album of different things, but pictures basically kind of explains the whole album. I mean, I write a lot of music from sitting at a piano that overlooks a window in my apartment that I had in Boston at the time. And so you sit at this piano, look out this window, and see the pictures of life, basically. You're just looking at life going by outside, all the things that go on. And, you know, this window frame that I'm looking through is the picture. And you're sitting at the piano and looking at these pictures going by, and as you're sitting playing the piano, you know, you're just playing around, noodling around, and you'd record yourself a lot. I'd record myself a lot doing that. And, you know, you would, the life and the pictures that you see would filter through your thought process and you know, kind of through your body into your fingers, and out it came through the piano. And, you know, you come up with music. I came up with a lot of music that way from that record, and just thinking about life and the things that go on, and also seeing it. So let's play Pictures.
Same Time Twice is your latest release. Is this your most satisfying session to date, Matthias?
Yeah, we sort of discussed before about the most satisfying release. You know, the Same Time Twice album, I mean, it was great to play. It was, you know, again, with Kurt Rosenwinkel on guitar, Mark Turner on saxophones, Ruben Rogers, acoustic bass, and Gregory Hutchison on drums. You know, getting that band together, that was a dream band for me. I had a lot of fun doing it, and, you know, I guess, you know, it was very satisfying to do, and of course there were always things I wish were different, but then again, you know, it is what it is on that day when you record it, and there it is. If we, you know, could have toured for a whole year as that unit, you know, toured for a whole year and then recorded that music, you know, it would be a different album, definitely. But what you're hearing there is, you know, five jazz musicians getting together after, you know, playing as a unit for a couple hours prior. And, you know, we didn't do a lot of rehearsing, you know, which is, you know, you have certain charts that there they are, and you know, they looked at the charts a bit, and then we play them. And, you know, that's the beauty of jazz. It's improvised music, so you're hearing their takes on looking at some notes on paper and the, you know, the emotions that they were carrying with them that day, and their abilities on their instruments, and, you know, what they can gather from their whole history of knowledge and pour it into that session, and that's what you get. And it's a combined effort, and, you know, I was very happy with it. You know, it has its flaws, of course, and there's certain things, if I could do over, I'd do over. But hey, you know, that's the growth process. And, you know, the next CD is going to be different players, probably, different music, different time, different day. It's just, it's always different. And, you know, just hope for the best, and, you know, try to be happy with your accomplishments that you do every day. And that's one of the big things too. You know, I think about a lot, you know, there are so many things in life that are important. And music to me is a very important thing, of course. At the same time, it's just music, you know, yet it's my life. So it's kind of a dilemma when you think about it. But it's just music. Yet, you know, it's so deeply rooted inside of me that it takes so much of my life up. You know, so when you say, you know, are you satisfied with this CD as a whole, it's always a hard thing to think about. And you know, you listen back to your CDs, you get too close to your music. That's the other issue. You get way too close to your music. You write the music, and then, you know, you maybe rehearse it a bit, and then you record it, and then you tour it. And then when you try to listen back to it, man, you're like, you've heard it so much, and you know it so well inside and out, that it's hard to listen to it from the right perspective. I mean, people that hear it for the first time, you know, with a different set of ears, it's just a totally different thing for that. So, you know, it's always fun to go back to your first, you know, when I go back and listen to my first records and hear them, you know, I always get a different feeling from them. So, you know, ask me that same question in 10 years. I probably have a better answer for you.
When you're performing, is there a particular setting that you like to play in? For example, maybe a solo setting or a duo, orchestral, or maybe even a group setting?
Yeah, I play in lots of different situations. I guess as a traveling jazz musician, I prefer doing a group thing, quartet, quintet. Usually, you know, right now I'm really into the more of the quintet sounds that I can get.
Within the group setting, is there anything that you're trying to accomplish that may be unique or different?
You know, within the quintet, as we tour, you know, I'm doing solo pieces, we're doing duet pieces, so trio pieces. And, it goes everything from, you know, soloist to quintet. And sometimes you're mixing in electronics and sampling as you're playing. So, you know, sextet, you know, if you're playing along with something that you've just sampled into your playing with looping devices or something with the new electronic age, you know, that adds another member to the group all of a sudden. So I guess, you know, that's sort of the group aspect of it. But I mean, I've definitely done solo acts where I've gone out and just done a solo thing or a duet. Orchestral playing, I can't say I've done too much. I did in my early days when I first started playing music. But for me, I'm all about the whole personal expression.
Personal expression is one thing, but in an orchestral setting, you have more restraints placed on you, I guess. I guess the focus might be, from a compositional point of view, the composer might be highlighted as opposed to the actual musician that's playing an arrangement or a piece.
I find in orchestral music, the personal expression is more of the composer than it is of the individual musician. So when you hear an orchestra, to me, I hear the emotions of the composer and of the orchestra as a whole. I don't really hear the emotions of each player. I mean, there are certain pieces, of course, where you can hear that, but I find in jazz where you improvise and you can really hear the player's emotions as opposed to a classical person playing everything note for note for note for note. You know, I find it harder to distinguish, in classical music, is that player really playing from the heart with every note he plays, or is he just reading the notes on the paper? It's hard for me to tell sometimes. But, I mean, I love classical music. I wish I had more time to listen to more music. There's so much great music out there. There's so much classical music, and I'd love to listen to. And jazz and rock, there's just so much.
Many years ago, in fact, it was in the 70s, L. Ron Hubbard was once quoted as saying, "Society is only great when it has aspiring artists and then good administrative people and then politicians." And he stressed them in that order. Do you have any comments on the importance of artists in society?
That's an interesting thing. I'd have to maybe reflect on that one a bit to comment more deeply on that. But, I mean, yeah, I definitely feel artists are important in society. You know, the world is a crazy place, let me tell you. I mean, you can just look at the news these days, what's going on in the world, and I mean, what has gone on in the world, if you look at history, I mean, it's mind-boggling how crazy and upside down everything really is. And as an artist, you know, I really, being an artist is a very peaceful thing. And it's a peaceful way to live. And you're just sort of, you know, you're creating art and writing about what you see in the world around you, I guess. And, you know, I think it's very important for people to, you know, listen to what the artists are doing and try to, you know, get a feel of what they're doing and reflect on it more too, you know, like, I mean, for me, when I listen to music and I really reflect on it, I feel a certain calmness usually over me, and I guess that sort of goes back to, you know, I mean, how do you define art too, you know, but, you know, when you, the question about today's popular music, you know, being a jazz musician, I mean, you're definitely not doing this for the money. I mean, jazz music, it's just, the money just is not there, like it is in the pop world. So, you can see the pop world and how backwards it has become in many ways due to the economics. And, you know, it's all about chasing the money for a lot of them. And if you look at a lot of the artists that are out there, their products, you know, they're just products of the record company, the product, you know. They're not artists that I would feel would, you know, had a definite thing to say. It was sort of, they were just put together, a lot of them, by the record companies. But, you know, I don't know. It's a hard question. There's a lot of great music out there still today that's popular. But, I mean, I think in terms of society and the importance of it, it's such a big topic. I mean, I don't know what else to say on that. It's a huge topic. Maybe for another day.
Talk a little about teaching. Do you hold many clinics, or do you teach in schools or universities? I know you're pretty busy with the Berklee School of Music.
Yeah, the whole teaching thing. You know, a lot of musicians end up having to do that because of the economics of the whole business. I work at Berklee. Help manage the percussion department. So I do more managing than I do teaching there. Occasionally I do teach a few students. But when I tour, I'm always usually doing some clinics along the way. So that helps supplement tours when you have a day off or a couple holes. You can, you know, do some clinics along the way. And it's great, you know, to see some other students and what they're doing. And, you know, you can talk about what you're doing, and you know, usually I do it with my group with me, and we play a few tunes and talk about what we're doing to the students. The students ask some questions, and then you sort of get, you know, this whole new perspective of when people talk to you about your music, as you know, you play it to them and they talk right back to you about what they thought about it and, you know, certain concepts. So it opens up your eyes to how people react to your music and what they think about it, and so, you know, it's a very cool thing.
Have you ever thought of making a recording that included just vibes, like maybe with Gary Burton and Bobby Hutcherson, and maybe throw in a few others for good measure?
An all vibes recording? I don't know. Never thought about that. You know, I sort of see my music as a mixture of the vibes with other instruments besides mallet instruments. So I've never really thought about doing something like that, but yeah, I mean, that could be sort of interesting. But for me, again, it's the element of writing my own music and finding the right players to record it with, to, you know, to convey what I'm trying to say artistically. So to do something like that with all vibe players or mal players probably wouldn't be up my alley in terms of really what I want to do artistically, but, you know, could be a fun side project.
Do you prefer performing or writing material?
Yeah, when you write your own material, it's a funny process. You can write, well, I guess it changes from person to person, but for me, my own personal experience, I write a lot from piano. I also write from my vibes. And sometimes you write from a rhythmic standpoint, maybe because I was a drummer too, I think that way at first, but everything comes a certain way at a certain time. And
does it take you long to write material, or does it come to you quickly?
Some things, you know, you can write a tune in 5 minutes. Other times you're working on a tune for months, and you know, you have a sort of an idea or concept, and it just comes to you, bang, and it's there, it is, it's done, and you write the whole tune and it works out. Other times you might get a fragment of a concept or something that spurs on a really, you know, feeling inside of you, and you have to let that feeling develop within you and your life as, you know, as you live your life. And, you know, you're practicing every day too. You try to keep up the practice routine and the writing routine, you know, on a try to do a daily basis. And, you know, over a month or so, you can see, you can nurture and develop this little thing that you've discovered. And you know it's something personal and deep, and you want to take it somewhere, and eventually, you know, it sort of blossoms into this tune, and there it is. There's a new piece, and, you know, it's It can be sometimes it's a real struggle, and other times it's just so quick. But on the same token, I'd like to point out, you know, it's like, I can't remember who said that, but you can try hard at something, or you can try easy at something. And that's something to really think about, for everybody in general, as human beings. If you try easy, you know, you try something hard or try something easy, try easy. You know, you're trying to do something, but instead of trying really hard at it, just, you know, relax, take a breath, and try easy. And that was, think about that for a while. It's a funny thought, but if you take that mentality, life can go a lot smoother.
What's left for you to do musically?
Anything left to do musically? Yeah. There's so much. There's so much you can't even talk about it. Musical journeys, settings. As you write music and you tour, you meet new players. This sort of opens up new possibilities to you that maybe you didn't think of before. There's a lot of players I'd love to play with. There's a lot of unwritten music I want to write. It's just a matter of time and timing to make it all happen. You kind of just live your life and practice and record and tour, and he sort of takes you where it goes, and you hope for the best, and hopefully you can accomplish all your goals. You try to keep a dream in front of you that you want to, what you want to do, and you chase that dream and fulfill it as much as possible and move on to the next dream. In terms of specifics, I want to record my, what I'm going to do next is record my touring band. We're going to, this time I want to try to record a band that I'm touring with quite a bit, and we're going to record with Kung Vu, the trumpet player, plays in Pat Metheny's group right now, a very kind of avant-garde-ish trumpet player who uses, these great effects with his trumpet, playing electronics with his trumpet. And, so this next CD is going to be a lot of a bit more electronic music, put my vibes to the electronics, and just exploring the new sonic abilities of electronics a bit, mixed with acoustic instruments and, this group of musicians. And they're not well-known players, but they're players that we have a good communication between us, and we have a good time on the road touring. So we're going to record this group and see what happens, be another experience for us.
Matthias, I'd like to thank you for dropping by today and spending some time with us.
Yeah, hey, Randy, thanks a lot for having me here. I appreciate you doing this and take the time out to do the whole interview. Take care.